Are you coming, Ming? The case officer's mind asked the air around him. Like most bars around the world, this one had a mirror behind the glasses and bottles. And the California native examined his face quizzically, pretending it was someone else's, wondering what someone else might see in it. Nervousness? Suspicion? Fear? Loneliness? Lust? There could be someone making that evaluation right now. Some MSS counterintelligence officer doing his stakeout. Careful not to look toward Nomori too much of the time. Maybe using the mirror as an indirect surveillance tool. More likely sitting at an angle so that his posture naturally pointed his eyes to the American. Whereas Nomori would have to turn his head to see him, giving the surveillance agent a chance to avert his glance, probably toward his partner. You tended to do this with teams rather than an individual, whose head would be on the same line of sight, so that he could survey his target without seeming to do so directly. Every nation in the world had police or security forces trained in this, and the methods were the same everywhere because human nature was the same everywhere, whether your target was a drug dealer or a spook. That's just the way it was, Nomori said to himself, checking his watch again. 11 minutes late. It's cool, buddy. Women are always late. They do it because they can't tell time. Or it takes them fucking forever to get dressed and do their makeup. Or because they don't remember to wear a watch. Or, most likely of all, because it gives them an advantage. Such behavior, perhaps, made women appear more valuable to men. After all, men waited for them, right? Not the other way around. It put a premium on their affection, which, if not waited for, might not appear one day, and that gave men something to fear. Chester Nomori, behavioral anthropologist, he snorted to himself, looking back up in the mirror. For Christ's sake, dude, maybe she's working late, or the traffic is heavy, or some friend at the office needed her to come over and help her move the goddamn furniture. 17 minutes. He fished out another cool and lit it from his Chi-Com lighter. The east is red, he thought. And maybe this was the last country in the world that really was red. Wouldn't Mao be proud? Where are you? Well, whoever from the MSS might be watching, if he had any doubts about what Nomori was doing, they'd damn sure know he was waiting for a woman. And if anything, his stress would look like that of a guy bewitched by the woman in question. And spooks weren't supposed to be bewitched, were they? What are you worrying about that for, asshole, just because you might not get laid tonight? 23 minutes late. He stubbed out one cigarette and lit another. If this was a mechanism women used to control men, then it was an effective one. James Bond never had these problems, the intelligence officer thought. Mr. Kiss-Kiss-Bang-Bang was always master of his women. And if anyone needed proof that Bond was a character of fiction, that was sure as hell it. As it turned out, Nomori was so entranced with his thoughts that he didn't see Ming come in. He felt a gentle tap on his back and turned rapidly to see. She wore the radiant smile, pleased with herself at having surprised him. The beaming dark eyes that crinkled at the corners with the pleasure of the moment.
"I am so sorry to be late," she said rapidly. "Fang needed me to transcribe some things, and he kept me in the office late."
"I must talk to this old man," Nomori said archly, hauling himself erect on the bar stool.
"He is, as you say, an old man, and he does not listen very well. Perhaps age has impeded his hearing."
"Now the old fucker probably doesn't want to listen," Nomori didn't say. Fang was probably like bosses everywhere, well past the age when he looked for the ideas of others. "So, what do you want for dinner?" Nomori asked, and got the best possible answer.
"I'm not hungry."
With sparkles in the dark eyes to affirm what she did want. Nomori tossed off the last of his drink, stubbed out his cigarette, and walked out with her. So? Ryan asked. So, this is not good news, Arnie Van Dam replied. I suppose that depends on your point of view. When will they hear arguments? Less than 2 months, and that's a message too, Jack. Those good, strict, constructionist justices you appointed are going to hear this case. And if I had to bet, I'd wager they're hot to overturn Roe. Jack settled back in his chair and smiled up at his chief of staff. Why is that bad, Arnie? Jack, it's bad because a lot of the citizens out there like to have the option to choose between abortion or not. That's why. Pro-choice is what they call it, and so far it's the law. Maybe that'll change, the president said hopefully, looking back down at his schedule. The Secretary of the Interior was coming in to talk about the national parks. That is not something to look forward to, damn it, and it'll be blamed on you. Okay, if and when that happens, I will point out that I am not a justice of the United States Supreme Court, and stay away from it entirely. If they decide the way I, and I guess you, think they will, abortion becomes a legislative matter, and the legislature of the several states, as the Constitution terms them, will meet and decide for themselves if the voters want to be able to kill their unborn babies or not. But Arnie, I've got 4 kids, remember. I was there to see them all born, and be damned if you are going to tell me that abortion is okay. The 4th little Ryan, Kyle Daniel, had been born during Ryan's presidency, and the cameras had been there to record his face coming out of the delivery room, allowing the entire nation, and the world for that matter, to share the experience. It had bumped Ryan's approval rating a full 15 points, pleasing Arnie very greatly at the time. God damn it, Jack, I never said that, did I? Van Dam demanded. But you and I do objectionable things every so often, don't we? And we don't deny other people the right to do such things, too, do we? Smoke, for example, he added, just to twist Ryan's tail a little. Arnie, you use words as cleverly as any man I know, and that was a good play. I'll give you that. But there's a qualitative difference between lighting up a goddamn cigarette and killing a living human being. True, if a fetus is a living human being, which is something for theologians, not politicians. Arnie, it's like this. The pro-abortion crowd says that whether or not a fetus is human is beside the point, because it's inside a woman's body, and therefore her property to do with as she pleases. Fine. It was the law in the Roman Republic and Empire that a wife and children were property of the paterfamilias, the head of the family, and he could kill them any time he pleased. You think we should go back to that? Obviously not, since it empowers men and disempowers women, and we don't do things like that anymore. So you've taken a moral issue and degraded it to what's good politically and what's bad politically. Well, Arnie, I am not here to do that. Even the president is allowed to have some moral principles, or am I supposed to check my ideas of right and wrong outside the door when I show up for work in the morning? But he's not allowed to impose it on others. Moral principles are things you keep on the inside for yourself. What we call law is nothing more or less than the public's collective belief, their conviction of what right and wrong is. Whether it's about murder, kidnapping, or running a red light, society decides what the rules are. In a democratic republic, we do that through the legislature by electing people who share our views. That's how laws happen. We also set up a constitution, the supreme law of the land, which is very carefully considered because it decides what the other laws may and may not do, and therefore it protects us against our transitory passions. The job of the judiciary is to interpret the laws, or in this case, the constitutional principles embodied in those laws, as they apply to reality. In Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court went too far. It legislated, it changed the law in a way not anticipated by the drafters, and that was an error. All a reversal of Roe will do is return the abortion issue to the state legislatures where it belongs. How long have you been thinking about that speech? Arnie asked. Ryan's turn of phrase was too polished for extemporaneous speech. A little while, the president admitted. Well, when that decision comes through, be ready for a firestorm, his chief of staff warned. I'm talking demonstrations, TV coverage, and enough newspaper editorials to paper the walls of the Pentagon. And your Secret Service people will worry about the additional danger to your life, and your wife's life, and your kids. If you think I'm kidding, ask them. Well, that doesn't make any sense. There's no law, federal, state, or local, which compels the world to be logical, Jack. The people out there depend on you to keep the fucking weather pleasant, and they blame you when you don't. Deal with it. With that, an annoyed chief of staff headed out and west toward his corner office. Crap, Ryan breathed, as he flipped to the briefing papers for the Secretary of the Interior. Smoky Bear's owner. Also custodian of the national parks, which the President only got to see on the Discovery Channel, on such nights as he had free time to switch the TV on. There wasn't much to be said for the clothing people wore in this place, Nomori thought again, except for one thing. When you undid the buttons and found the Victoria's Secret stuff underneath, well, it was like having a movie switch from black and white to Technicolor. This time Ming allowed him to do her buttons, then slide the jacket down her arms, and then get her trousers off. The panties looked particularly inviting, but then so did her entire body. Nomori scooped her up in his arms and kissed her passionately before dropping her on the bed. A minute later, he was beside her. "So, why were you late?" She made a face. "Every week Minister Fang meets with other ministers, and when he comes back, he has me transcribe the notes of the meetings so that he has a record of everything that was said."
"Oh, do you use my new computer for that?"
The question concealed the quivering Jesus he felt throughout his body on hearing Ming's words. This girl could be one hell of a source. Nomori took a deep breath and resumed his poker face of polite disinterest.
"Of course."
"Excellent. It's equipped with a modem, yes?"
"Of course. I use it every day to retrieve Western news reports and such from their media websites."
"Ah, that is good." So he'd taken care of business for the day, and with that job done, Nomori leaned over for a kiss.
"Before I came into the restaurant, I put the lipstick on," Ming explained. "I don't wear it at work."
"So I see," the CIA officer replied, repeating the initial kiss, and extending it in time. Her arms found their way around his neck. The reason for her lateness had nothing to do with a lack of affection. That was obvious now, as his hands started to wander also. The front closure on the bra was the smartest thing he'd done. Just a flick of thumb and forefinger and it sprang open, revealing both of her rather cute breasts. Two more places for his hand to explore. The skin there was particularly silky, and, he decided a few seconds later, tasty as well. This resulted in an agreeable moan and squirm of pleasure from his, what, friend? Well, okay, but not enough. Agent? Not yet. Lover would do for the moment. They'd never talked at the farm about this sort of thing, except the usual warnings not to get too close to your agent, lest you lose your objectivity. But if you didn't get a little bit close, you'd never recruit the agent, would you? Of course, Chester knew that he was far more than a little bit close at the moment. Whatever her looks, she had delightful skin, and his fingertips examined it in great detail as his eyes smiled into hers, with the occasional kiss. And her body wasn't bad at all, a nice shape even when she stood. A little too much waist, maybe, but this wasn't Venice Beach, and the hourglass figure, however nice it might look in pictures, was just that, a picture look. Her waist was smaller than her hips, and that was enough for the moment. It wasn't as though she'd be walking down the ramp at some New York fashion show, where the models looked like boys anyway. So, Ming is not now and would never be a supermodel. Deal with it, Chet, the officer told himself. Then it was time to put all the CIA stuff aside. He was a man dressed only in boxer shorts, next to a woman dressed only in panties. Panties large enough, maybe, to make a handkerchief, though orange-red wouldn't be a good color for a man to pull from his back pocket. Especially, he added to himself with a smile, in some artificial silk fabric.
"Why do you smile?" Ming asked.
"Because you are pretty," Nomori replied. And so she was, now, with that particular smile on her face. No, she'd never be a model, but inside every woman was the look of beauty, if only they would let it out. And her skin was first class, especially her lips, coated with after-work lipstick, smooth and greasy, yet making his lips linger even so. Soon their bodies touched almost all over, and a warm, comfortable feeling it was. So nicely she fit under one arm, while his left hand played and wandered. Ming's hair didn't tangle much. She could evidently brush it out very easily. It was so short. Her underarms, too, were hairy, like many Chinese women's, but that only gave Nomori something else to play with, teasing and pulling a little. That evidently tickled her. Ming giggled playfully and hugged him tighter, then relaxed to allow his hand to wander more. As it passed her navel, she lay suddenly still, relaxing herself in some kind of invitation. Time for another kiss as his fingertips wandered farther. And there was humor in her eyes now. What game could this be? As soon as his hands found her panties, her bottom lifted off the mattress. He sat up halfway and pulled them down, allowing her left foot to kick them into the air, where the red-orange pants flew like a monocolored rainbow, and then... "Ming!" he said in humorous accusation.
"I've heard that men like this," she said with a sparkle and a giggle.
"Well, it is different," Nomori replied, as his hands traced over skin even smoother than the rest of her body. "Did you do this at work?" A riotous laugh now.
"No, fool! This morning at my apartment, in my own bathroom, with my own razor."
"Just wanted to make sure," the CIA officer assured her.
"Damn, isn't this something?"
Then her hand moved to do to him much the same as he was doing to her.
"You are different from Fang," her voice told him in a playful whisper.
"Oh? How so?"
"I think the worst thing a woman can say to a man is, 'Are you in yet?' One of the other secretaries said that to Fang once. He beat her. She came into work the next day with black eyes. He made her come in. And then the next night... Well, he had me to bed," she admitted, not so much with shame as embarrassment. "To show what a man he still is. But I knew better than to say that to him. We all do now."
"Will you say that to me?" Nomori asked with a smile and another kiss.
"Oh, no. You are a sausage, not a string bean," Ming told him enthusiastically.
It wasn't the most elegant compliment he'd ever had, but it sufficed for the moment, Nomori thought. "Do you think it's time for the sausage to find a home?"
"Oh, yes."
As he rolled on top, Nomori saw two things under him. One was a girl, a young woman with the usual female drives, which he was about to answer. The other was a potential agent, with access to political intelligence such as an experienced case officer only dreamed about. But Nomori wasn't an experienced case officer. He was still a little wet behind the ears, and so he didn't know what was impossible. He'd have to worry about his potential agent, because if he ever recruited her successfully, her life would be in the gravest danger. He thought about what would happen, how her face would change as the bullet entered her brain. But no, it was too ugly. With an effort, Nomori forced the thought aside as he slipped into her. If he were to recruit her at all, he had to perform this function well. And if it made him happy too, well, that was just a bonus. "I'll think about it," POTUS promised the Secretary of the Interior, walking him to the door that led to the corridor to the left of the fireplace. "Sorry, buddy, but the money isn't there to do all that." His Sec Interior was by no means a bad man, but it seemed he'd been captured by his departmental bureaucracy, which was perhaps the worst danger of working in Washington. He sat back down to read the papers the secretary had handed over. Of course, he wouldn't have time to read it all over himself. On a good day, he'd be able to skim through the executive summary of the documents, while the rest went to a staffer who'd go through it all and draft a report to the president. In effect, another executive summary of sorts. And from that document, typed up by a White House staff member of maybe 28 years, policy would actually be made. And that was crazy, Ryan thought angrily. He was supposed to be the chief executive of the country. He was the only one who was supposed to make policy. But the president's time was valuable. So valuable, in fact, that others guarded it for him. And really, those others guarded his time from himself. Because, ultimately, it was they who decided what Ryan saw and didn't see. Thus, while Ryan was the chief executive, and did alone make executive policy, he made that policy often based solely on the information presented to him by others. And sometimes it worried him that he was controlled by the information that made it to his desk, rather as the press decided what the public saw, and thus had a hand in deciding what the public thought about the various issues of the day. "So, Jack, have you been captured by your bureaucracy, too?" It was hard to know, hard to tell, and hard to decide how to change the situation, if the situation existed in the first place. "Maybe that's why Arnie likes me to get out of this building to where the real people are," Jack realized. The more difficult problem was that Ryan was a foreign policy and national security expert. In those areas he felt the most competent. It was on domestic stuff that he felt disconnected and dumb. Part of that came from his personal wealth. He'd never worried about the cost of a loaf of bread or a quart of milk. All the more so in the White House, where you never saw milk in a quart container anyway, but only in a chilled glass on a silver tray, carried by a Navy steward's mate right to your hands while you sat in your easy chair. There were people out there who did worry about such things, or at least worried about the cost of putting little Jimmy through college, and Ryan, as president, had to concern himself with their worries. He had to try to keep the economy in balance so that they could earn their decent livings, could go to Disney World in the summer and the football games in the fall, and splurge to make sure there were plenty of presents under the Christmas tree every year. But how the hell was he supposed to do that? Ryan remembered a lament attributed to the Roman Emperor Caesar Augustus. On learning that he'd been declared a god, and that temples had been erected to him, and that people sacrificed to the statues of himself in those temples, Augustus angrily inquired, "When someone prays to me to cure his gout, what am I supposed to do?" The fundamental issue was how much government policy really had to do with reality. That was a question seldom posed in Washington, even by conservatives who ideologically despised the government and everything it did in domestic terms, though they were often in favor of showing the flag and rattling the national saber overseas. Exactly why they enjoyed this, Ryan had never thought about. Perhaps just to be different from liberals who flinched from the exercise of force like a vampire from the cross, but who, like vampires, liked to extend government as far as they could get away with into the lives of everyone, and so suck their blood. In reality, use the instrument of taxation to take more and more to pay for the more and more they would have the government do. And yet the economy seemed to move on, regardless of what government did. People found their jobs, most of them in the private sector, providing goods and services for which people paid voluntarily with their after-tax money. And yet public service was a phrase used almost exclusively by and about political figures, almost always the elected sort. Didn't everyone out there serve the public in one way or another? Physicians, teachers, firefighters, pharmacists? Why did the media say it was just Ryan and Robbie Jackson, and the 535 elected members of the Congress? He shook his head. Damn. Okay, I know how I got here. But why the hell did I allow myself to run for election? Jack asked himself. It had made Arnie happy. It had even made the media happy. Perhaps because they loved him as a target, the president asked himself. And Kathy had not been cross with him about it. But why the hell had he ever allowed himself to be stampeded into this? He fundamentally didn't know what he was supposed to do as president. He had no real agenda, and sort of bumped along from day to day, making tactical decisions, for which he was singularly unqualified, instead of large strategic ones. There was nothing important he really wanted to change about his country. Oh, sure, there were a few problems to be fixed. Tax policy needed rewriting, and he was letting George Winston ramrod that. And defense needed firming up, and he had Tony Brentano working on that. He had a presidential commission looking at health care policy, which his wife actually was overseeing in a distant way, along with some of her Hopkins colleagues, and all of that was kept quiet. And there was that very black look at Social Security, being guided by Winston and Mark Gant. The third rail of American politics, he thought again. Step on it and die. But Social Security was something the American people really cared about, not for what it was, but for what they wrongly thought it to be. And actually, they knew that their thoughts were wrong, judging by the polling data. As thoroughly mismanaged as any financial institution could possibly be, it was still part of a government promise made by the representatives of the people to the people. And somehow, despite all the cynicism out there, which was considerable, the average Joe citizen really did trust his government to keep its word. The problem was that union chiefs and industrialists who dipped into pension funds and gone to federal prison for it had done nothing compared to what succeeding Congresses had done to Social Security. But the advantage of a crook in Congress was that he or she was not a crook. Not legally. After all, Congress made the law. Congress made government policy. And those things couldn't be wrong, could they? Yet another proof that the drafters of the Constitution had made one simple but far-reaching error. They'd assumed that the people selected by the people to manage the nation would be as honest and honorable as they'd been. One could almost hear the oops emanating from all those old graves. The people who drafted the Constitution had sat in a room dominated by George Washington himself, and whatever honor they'd lacked, he'd probably provided from his own abundant supply, just by sitting there and looking at them. The current Congress had no such mentor-slash-living-god to take George's place. And more was the pity, Ryan thought. The mere fact that Social Security had shown a profit up through the 1960s had meant that, well, Congress couldn't let a profit happen, could it? Profits were what made rich people, who had to be bad people because no one grew rich without having exploited someone or other, right? Which never stopped members of the Congress from going to those people for campaign contributions, of course. Rich. And so profits had to be spent. And so Social Security taxes, properly called premiums, because Social Security was actually called OASDI, for Old Age, Survivors, and Disability Insurance, were transformed into general funds, to be spent along with everything else. One of Ryan's students, from his days of teaching history at the Naval Academy, had sent him a small plaque to keep on his White House desk. It read, "The American Republic will endure until the day Congress discovers that it can bribe the public with the public's money." Alexis de Tocqueville. Ryan paid heed to it. There were times when he wanted to grab Congress by its collective neck and throttle it. But there was no single such neck, and Arnie never tired of telling him how tame a Congress he had, the House of Representatives especially, which was the reverse of how things usually went. The President grumbled and checked his daily schedule for his next appointment. As with everything else, the President of the United States lived a schedule determined by others. His appointments made weeks in advance. The daily briefing pages prepared the day before so that he'd know who the hell was coming in, and what the hell he, she, or they wanted to talk about, and also what his considered position, mainly drafted by others, was. The President's position was usually a friendly one, so that the visitors, could leave the Oval Office feeling good about the experience, and the rules were that you couldn't change the agenda, lest the chief executive say, "What the hell are you asking me for now?" This would alarm both the guest and the Secret Service agents standing right behind them, hands close to their pistols, just standing there like robots, faces blank but scanning, ears taking everything in. After their shift ended, they probably headed off to whatever cop bar they frequented to chuckle over what the City Council President of Podunk had said in the Oval Office that day. "Jesus, did you see the boss's eyes when that dumb bastard..." Because they were bright, savvy people, who in many ways understood his job better than he did, Ryan reflected. Well, they should. They had the double advantage of having seen it all, and not being responsible for any of it. Lucky bastards, Jack thought, standing for his next appointment. If cigarettes were good for anything, it was for this, Nomori thought. His left arm was curled around Ming, his body snuggled up against her, staring at the ceiling in the lovely, relaxed, deflationary moment, and puffing gently on his cool, as an accent to the moment, feeling Ming's breathing, and feeling very much like a man. The sky outside the windows was dark. The sun had set. Nomori stood, stopping first in the bathroom and then heading to the kitchenette. He returned with two wine glasses. Ming sat up in bed and took a sip from hers. For his part, Nomori couldn't resist reaching over to touch her. Her skin was just so smooth and inviting. "My brain is still not working," she said after her third sip. "Darling, there are times when men and women don't need their brains." "Well, your sausage doesn't need one," she responded, reaching down to fondle it.
"Gently, girl. He's run a long, hard race," the CIA officer warned her with an inner smile.
"Oh, so he has."
Ming bent down to deliver a gentle kiss.
"And he won the race?"
"No, but he did manage to catch up with you." Nomori lit another cigarette. Then he was surprised to see Ming reach into her purse and pull out one of her own. She lit it with grace and took a long puff, finally letting the smoke out her nose. "Dragon girl," Nomori announced with a laugh. "Do flames come next? I didn't know you smoked."
"At the office, everyone does."
"Even the minister?" Another laugh.
"Especially the minister."
"Someone should tell him that smoking is dangerous to the health, and not good for the yang."
"A smoked sausage is not a firm sausage," Ming said with a laugh. "Maybe that's his problem, then."
"You do not like your minister?"
"He is an old man with what he thinks is a young penis. He uses the office staff as his personal bordello." "Well, it could be worse," Ming admitted. "It's been a long time since I was his favorite. Lately he's fixed on Chai, and she is engaged, and Fang knows it. That is not a civilized act on the part of a senior minister."
"The laws do not apply to him?"
She snorted with borderline disgust. "The laws apply to none of them. Nomori-san, these are government ministers. They are the law in this country, and they care little for what others think of them or their habits.
Few enough find out in any case. They are corrupt on a scale that shames the emperors of old. And they say they are the guardians of the common people, the peasants and workers they claim to love as their own children. Well, I suppose sometimes I am one of those peasants, eh?
And I thought you liked your minister, Nomori responded, goading her on.
So, what does he talk about?
What do you mean?
The late work that kept you away from here, he answered, waving at the bedclothes with a smile.
Oh, talk between the ministers. He keeps an extensive personal political diary, in case the president might want to oust him. That is his defense, you see. Something he could present to his peers. Fang doesn't want to lose his official residence and all the privileges that come along with it. So he keeps records of all he does, and I am his secretary, and I transcribe all his notes. Sometimes it can take forever.
On your computer, of course.
Yes, the new one.
In perfect Mandarin ideographs, now that you've given us the new software.
You keep it on your computer?
On the hard drive, yes.
Oh, it's encrypted, she assured him. We learned that from the Americans when we broke into their weapons records. It's called a robust encryption system, whatever that means. I select the file I wish to open and type in the decryption key, and the file opens.
Do you want to know what key I use?
She giggled.
Yellow Submarine. In English, because of the keyboard. It was before your new software, and it's from a Beatles song I heard on the radio once. We all live in a yellow submarine, something like that. I listened to the radio a lot back then, when I was first studying English. I spent half an hour looking up submarines in the dictionary, and then the encyclopedia, trying to find out why a ship was painted yellow.
Ah!
Her hands flew up in the air. The encryption key. Nomori tried to hide his excitement.
Well, it must be a lot of folders. You've been his secretary for a lot of time, he said casually.
Over 400 documents. I keep them by number instead of making up new names for them. Today was number 487, as a matter of fact.
Holy shit, Nomori thought. 487 computer documents of inside the Politburo conversations. This makes a gold mine look like a toxic waste dump.
What exactly do they talk about? I've never met a senior government functionary, Nomori explained.
Everything,
she answered, finishing her own cigarette. Who's got ideas in the Politburo? Who wants to be nice to America? Who wants to hurt them?
Everything you can imagine. Defense policy, economic policy. The big one lately is how to deal with Hong Kong. One country, two systems has developed problems with some industrialists around Beijing and Shanghai. They feel they are treated with less respect than they deserve. Less than they get in Hong Kong, that is. And they are unhappy about it. Fang's one of the people trying to find a compromise to make them happy.
He might. He's very clever at such things.
It must be fascinating to see such information, to really know what's going on in your country, Nomori gushed. In Japan, we never know what the Zaibatsu and the Meaty people are doing, ruining the economy for the most part, the fools. But because nobody knows, no action is ever taken to fix things.
Is it the same here?
Of course.
She lit another smoke, getting into the conversation, and hardly noticing that it wasn't about love anymore.
Once I studied my Marx and my Mao. Once I believed in it all. Once I even trusted the senior ministers to be men of honor and integrity, and totally believed the things they taught me in school. But then I saw how the army has its own industrial empire, and that empire keeps the generals rich and fat and happy. And I saw how the ministers use women, and how they furnish their apartments. They've become the new emperors. They have too much power. Perhaps a woman could use such power without being corrupted, but not a man.
Feminism's made it over here, too, Nomori reflected,
Maybe she was too young to remember Mao's wife, Zhang Qing, who could have given corruption lessons to the court of Byzantium. Well, that is not a problem for people like us. At least you get to see such things, and at least you get to know it. That makes you even more unique, Ming Chan, Nomori suggested, tracing the palm of his hand over her left nipple. She shivered right on command.
You think so?
Of course.
A kiss this time, a nice lingering one, while his hand stroked her body.
He was so close.
She had told him of all the information she had. She'd even given him the fucking encryption key. So her pewter was wired into the phone system. That meant he could call into it. And with the right software, he could go snooping around her hard drive. And with the encryption key, he could lift things right off, and crossload them right to Mary Pat's desk.
Damn, first I get to fuck a Chinese citizen, and then I can fuck their whole country.
It didn't get much better than this, the field spook decided, with a smile at the ceiling.
Chapter 13 Penetration Agent.
Well, he left the prurient parts out this time, Mary Pat saw when she lit up her computer in the morning. Operation Zorga was moving right along. Whoever this Ming girl was, she talked a little too much. Odd. Hadn't the MSS briefed all the executive secretaries about this sort of thing? Probably. It would have been a remarkable oversight if they hadn't. But it also seemed likely that of the well-known reasons for committing treason and espionage, known as MICE, money, ideology, conscience, and ego, this one was ego. Young Miss Ming was being used sexually by her minister Fang, and she didn't much like it. And that made perfect sense to Mary Patricia Foley. A woman only had so much to give, and to have it taken coercively by a man of power wasn't something calculated to make a woman happy. Though, ironically, the powerful man in question probably thought he was honoring her with his biological attention. After all, was he not a great man? And was she not a peasant? The thought was good for a snort as she took a sip of morning seventh-floor coffee. It didn't matter what culture or race, men were all the same, weren't they? So many of them fought from the dick instead of the brain. Well, it was going to cost this one dearly, the deputy director, operations, concluded. Ryan saw and heard the PDB, the president's daily brief, every day. It covered intelligence information developed by CIA, was prepared late every night and printed early every morning. And there were less than 100 copies, almost all of which were shredded and burned later in the day of delivery. A few copies, maybe 3 or 4, were kept as archives, in case the electronic files somehow got corrupted. But even President Ryan didn't know where the secure storage site was. He hoped it was carefully guarded, preferably by Marines. The PDB didn't contain everything, of course. Some things were so secret that even the President couldn't be trusted. That was something Ryan accepted with remarkable equanimity. Sources' names had to remain secret, even from him. And methods were often so narrowly technical that he'd have trouble understanding the technology used anyway. But even some of the take, the information obtained by the CIA through nameless sources and overly intricate methods, was occasionally hidden from the chief executive, because some information had to come from a certain limited number of sources.